Okay, today is February 1st, 2016, a beautiful yet a cold morning in Jerusalem, but the worst is over. Let's see what happens. Purim time, traditionally rain or snow, but this year it's two Adarim, so we're bound to get better weather. Now, we spoke last week about two main topics. One was that Chabad, people give, and not only people give, but Chabad has attracted billionaires who help out substantially with Chabad in Russia and Israel, all over the world. And I mentioned, among other names, the Sam Raw family, George is his son, the late Sammy Raw, and that's a family you have to admire, that in Russia they're always willing to put in seed money, they're always willing to help. College campuses, it's endless stucca that the Roth family does. You take Leib Levayoff, anyone living in Israel knows the name Leib Levayoff, and here too is an example of a Bukharin who is loyal to his roots and helps Chabad all over the world and helps Bukharin Jewry all over the world. I mentioned, so they got involved in the question, why doesn't YU have people on this level? And there are many answers. One answer is very simple, that when you give to Chabad, you're giving to something that's universal. YU, when all is said and done, is limited to Washington Heights, to the American scene, with a little branch in Israel, which was forced upon them. When all is said and done, YU did not seek to be here, did not want to be here. And the story of how Gris came to be is basically a Bidiyevit story, not a Lachatchila story. So I was quoting Chaim Dalfin's book. Evidently, when I spoke about Chabad having millionaires who put heavy money on the table, people probably thought I was quoting Chaim Dalfin as well, and he wrote me an email. I imagine people came to him, Chaim, if you know all these millionaires, why not send them our way? So I want to make clear it's Rakefet speaking. And what I mean by millions on the table, I can give you a very simple example. When Roa agrees to fund any Chabad house all over the United States and Canada, you're dealing with someone putting heavy money on the table. When Leib Levayoff agrees to fund anything you're going to do in Russia, Soviet Russia today, or the former Soviet Russia, so again, you have an example of someone putting heavy money on the table. All right, we'll let that stand, but I wanted to clarify myself to take the heat off Chaim Dalfin, but I still believe my statement is essentially correct. It's not Shas and Paiskim, it's only one man's opinion. It's not Das Tera. Then we went into a second topic, which is very fascinating, the non-judgmental attitude of Chabad. And we're going to evolve that topic today. But as I said last week, this goes back to the Baal Tanya. When you look at Perek Lamed Bet, and you look, I showed you two English translations, one which doesn't do much, but two which elaborates and actually explains what it means, Yaakov Avinu, and simply the Rachmanut, the good feeling that every Jew has within him. You just have to bring it out. David HaMelech maledicted those who are Yvei Hashem, but Chabad will not do that, and that's Perek Lamed Bet. What's interesting is, and I mentioned this as well last week, that Perek Lamed Bet is limited to Chabadnikim, to Enash, to use the term I introduced many months ago. But as you come down the line, particularly the 5th Rebbe, the 6th Rebbe, and of course the 7th Rebbe, it applies to every Jew ba'ashehu shem. And I think, Alan, come close, Jason, it's good. So I think it's a reflection of life that during the 5th Rebbe's lifetime, you had more and more of a breakaway. And as the Rebbe said before, World War I, when he grew up, his early years, you don't remember Machalos Shabbos. The Rebbe said it has to be in Pruzhana probably, that there were two Machalalei Shabbos. One was the doctor, one was the pharmacist. And he said they were just as they were Machalalei Shabbos, they weren't good doctors and they weren't good pharmacists. The Zelbazach Echet Machalal Given the Aveda. But after World War I, Lo Aleinu, Chilul Shabbos became the norm. And then you phrase, you're going to be like Rakefet and maledictum achalot Shabbos l'machinim al titikva, or you're going to say, no, every Jew, you have to be non-judgmental and be makarev and look for the good, etc. Now, Rabbi Rubin asked me what the source is. So in my mind, I knew it's in Hilchot Deyot, but I didn't have the exact perek. I looked it up. It's Hilchot Deyot, perek Shishi. Alex, come close. Almost all of perek Shishi is devoted to this topic. And if you know how to work with the Rambam, which I'm sure everyone in this level of learning knows, you'll find all the Gemaras through the Nosei Kelim. Because it's many Gemaras the Rambam is quoting, he puts together. And Ein Hachinami, the whole mitzvah of Hokacha, and when you're Mochiach, and when you shouldn't be Mochiach, is right there in Perek Vav of the Rambam. But if we'll say Hokacha shouldn't be done when it doesn't help, then Chabad expanded it ad infinitum. And this is Chabad, this is their attitude. I was spitting bitter pills last week, telling you about what I saw in America, the downside. And the downside, it's all over the place. If Lakewood could have, if not Lakewood, if Agudat Yisrael could have a public session in OTD, so I saw all over the place people who were raised in, by firm parents and got good chinuch, and I was at Yeshiva University, and I saw these kids without kippah, not putting on tefillin, not davening, and one kid told his mother was arguing with him. He said, well, listen, wearing a kippah, It's not a d'oraita, it's not even a d'rabbanan, it's only a minhag. And I mentioned, I said, a kid has to tell me that. I mean, azam aretz b'nichnish, but nevertheless, a kippah represents something today. So someone sent me a source from the Alter Rebbe, from the Rebbe Shulchan Aruch, where the Rebbe writes, U'midet chasidit shelo leilech dal ramot begili rosh. And the Rebbe gives a very interesting explanation. This is the Alter Rebbe, the Baal Tanya. He says, and even though years ago most of the Jews walked Begilui Rosh, in other words, he's alluding to the Gemara that covering your head was only for big Talmidei Chachamim, big Tzaddikim, but the majority of the people walked Begilui Rosh, Mipnei Chachom B'yamim Hachem. Because they lived in a hot climate. It's interesting because the Baal Tanya, of course, lived in White Russia, in Russia. I mean, what was his background? Very cold. But there it was warm. But nevertheless, he says today, listen to this, that today you're not allowed to walk, even to sit Begilui Rosh, mipnei tzniut, shaharei zek magale basaro hamechuseh. And what he's saying is that today we're so used to wearing the kippah that if you don't wear it, it's like revealing a part of your body that should always be covered. It's not tzanu'. He's applying here an interesting concept. Now, a wise guy could ask a serious question. Would this apply in Israel where the climate is hot? In other words, in Russia, where you remember what I told you, I write about it in Washington, and it really happened to me. You know, a human being is a funny animal. When we came out of the hotel our first morning in Russia, and remember, we had gone through the KGB at night, we finally reached the hotel 2 in the morning, went to, anyway, come out at about 9 o'clock in the morning, and we want to find where the shul is because we have to be there Shabbos, and obviously you can't ask, we're working with a map. And we come out, and I'll never forget, I thought, I'm back in Geula, everyone is wearing a shtreimel. Then I realized the men and the women are wearing shtreimels, and it has to do with the weather. And by the way, that sentence I left out of my book was that if the woman who did the work for Geffen, very capable, obviously a Bala Tshuva, must be married to a husband who wears a shtreimel Shabbos, so she brought me sources what a shtreimel really means. Because I wrote, you can see that it's a winter garment from Russia. So I said, you know, if that sentence offends you, knock it out. I don't want to do anything offensive. So it's interesting what he says, that there's sneer involved. But now I want to take the story one step further. And I want to tell you on this question of non-judgmental, I want to tell you an absolute true story, and I'll mention the name of the person involved too. Raoul Wallenberg saved a family named Gluck, G-L-U-C-K. The Gluck family, there were three sons at the time, a mother and father. They were in a safe house in Budapest. The last day of the war, the Nazis came in and lined them up against the wall and started shooting in the safe house. They killed one Jew, Lo Aleinu, and when they were about to shoot the next Jew, the Russians badged in. They had just conquered, killed every Nazi in sight, and gave the Jews, I think, 48 hours to kill anyone they want. That's why, you know, the memoir literature, that the Germans prayed that the American army conquered them, not the Russian army. Okay, so the Gluck family was saved. They came to America, and they were impoverished. I don't have to tell you, they had been a well-to-do, successful family. I think they had a furniture business there. They were in business in Budapest. They came to America, and the older two boys, George and Ivan, went to RJJ. RJJ took in a lot of refugees. Them was Gedaf Oisleren in Yiddish because they spoke Hungarian, usual story. Then the father already got started in the import-export business, so he's a little well-to-do. So his third son, Jackie, went to MTA. Jackie's an MTA graduate, a little bit after my time. Jackie's younger than I am, not by much, but younger. He still had Rabbi Macy Gordon. Whenever I would mention Rabbi Gordon to him, he would tense up, you understand? So, and Jackie's an Elich, they're all Elich. Then they had a fourth son in America, Bobby. Where do you think Bobby went? Now they're doing well in business. Bobby went to Ramaz. So you have the four boys, three and one. Who do you think wears the black hat of the four sons? The Ramaz graduate, he wears the black hat. Now, Jackie and Ivan and George all lived in Woodmere. Bobby lived in Lawrence. But life moves on, and today George lives in Israel with his children, who are students of mine, and Ivan and Jackie both live basically in Florida. Jackie lives in Bell Harbor. Now, Jackie tells me the following story. It has to be 100% true. Jackie is telling it. There's no reason. He told me this years ago. He comes down to Bell Harbor, and those of you who know Bell Harbor, the largest Chabad shul in the world is there, the most successful Chabad shul. It's called The Shul. It's on Collins Avenue. It was built years ago. At the time it was built, it cost $9 million to build. Today you're talking a $20 million deal. And it's unbelievable. The shul, Rabbi Lipska, you're talking, he runs organizations out of there, and he gets a big crowd on Shabbos. And within the shul, they brought in a shul from Poland. It's a shtibel within the shul. You have the Polish, the Oren HaKodesh, and where the shtender, where you read the Torah, and the grill work. It is a sight to see. So Jackie comes down to the neighborhood, and he davens there. Maybe it's his first, second Shabbat there, and he notices a guy is sitting near him with a black hat, wearing a gartel, davening. No. Jackie, the second Shabbat, he sees him. Jackie asks, where are you from? And the guy tells, oh, I live in this community 25 miles away. So he says to him very innocently, where do you stay for Shabbos that you're davening here? So the guy says, no, I drive in. This is my Rebbe. I drive. And there's a guy with a black hat and a gatel. And Jackie, you know, was really shaken up. But I told him, this is Chabad, that they're non-judgmental and they're never going to yell at this guy or scream at him. They hope ultimately his heart will open and we're going to talk about this. This is Chabad. Okay. Now, Jackie finds Dulce Jufmilu with Bal Haba, so of course there are people who don't want to daven in Chabad, or the davening begins too late. It's a very long davening. It begins late, as Chabad does, and he speaks before everybody. He's like a king. It's like Lahavdil in conservative temples. Their rabbis, when they would get up to speak, they thought Moses was coming down Har Sinai. Rabbi Wolpe in his temple in what he called it, in Los Angeles on Wilshire Boulevard. So this rabbi, and then he gives a drasha, and the people worship him. So around the corner, on top of the bank, they took a few offices, knocked it out, and they built a young Israel, a small young Israel. Years move on, and Jackie now and the Balabatim have a dream of building a shul to rival the shul, with the blessing of the Chabadnik, I have to say, no hot feeling, Adarabba Kinat Sofrim, Tarbe Chochma, and you can't believe $12.5 million. This shul was just dedicated Hanukkah. Yours truly was the first guest speaker in the shul. A graduate of this kollel has a full-time job. Rabbi Avi Fried has a full-time job in the shul, involved with youth outreach, running that part of the program. The shul, you recognize Jerusalem stone, the inside by Kibbutz Lavi, Ein Aniyut B'Mokam Ashirut. You can't believe how beautiful and small. It's not a big shul. It can seat, I think, max 275 people. They say during the summer it's more than big enough, even Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, because no one is in Florida. During the winter, it takan has overflow crowd, but let it be. Beautiful, beautiful shul. So I asked Jackie. Jackie was chairman of the building committee, and he's a very sincere and able Jew. I can tell you what, Baruch Hashem. So I asked Jackie, how did you raise this money? So he started telling me stories, what this one, you know, there's some heavy hitters down there. But one story stuck in my mind, and here is exactly non-judgmental. The first story with Jackie is non-judgmental on Rabbi Lipska's part. Jackie was flabbergasted. The second story is non-judgmental on Jackie's part, and here's what he told me. This one gave $2 million, this one, that one. One person walked into the old shul above the bank a year or two ago on Shabbos, not dressed properly. And Jackie went over, Shalom Aleichem, Shabbat Shalom, and the Jew started talking with Jackie after davening that he's an Israeli, did very well in America, owns shopping malls, but he's no longer Shomer Shabbos. So Jackie said, look, whenever you want to come to shul, you sit next to me. P.S. This guy gave $1 million in honor of the way Jackie welcomed him and didn't tell him off. Non-judgmental in the full sense of the word. And by the way, he needs to show me Shabbos today. So you see, he came full cycle. So this concept of being non-judgmental, this is Chabad. Now, how do the rest of the Chabad world is unique? How do the rest of the Hasidim react to this? And remember, Chabad doesn't stand still. They will always be out there to play the crowd. Mm-hmm. Whenever something is happening, whenever something is going on, and you'll understand why I'm giving you this introduction a few minutes. Whenever something is going on, Chabad is there. They're walking up and down. They're looking at the crowd. I told you more than once what happens in Kriyat HaMegillah in Rechavia. I gained from it personally, because my wife can wake up at a later time. She doesn't have to hear Megillah early in the morning. And she walks a 1 minute walk from the house to the corner. They're laying the Megillah on the street, right outside the store. They can't lay it in the store because there are too many people. So there's, you know, the steps going up the Chalap. A few, 100, 200 people are sitting on the steps. And the Chabadnik is laying at the foot of the steps. And this is going on every hour on the hour in a different store, different location, on Rehov Azer and on Rehov Keren Chaimet Yisrael, right where Morty lives, right? Okay, this is Chabad. They Purim, and if there's a big event, if there'll be a parade in Israel, I guarantee you Chabad will be walking up and down. Did you put on tefillin? Did you put on tefillin? Etc. And I write about it the morning that I went into the army, Shehit Chayalti Bi. So that morning, you know, we're at Rehov Rashi, we're waiting for the buses to take us to Bakum, to Basis Klitam Miyun in Tel HaShomer, and nothing is ever exactly on the minute, nor can it be, because people have to be processed on Rehov Rashi, that you showed up, that you're here, you have to assign where you're going, they have to know what they're doing with you. So right away, Chabadnik can take out tefillin, and I'm walking up and down the crowd, who put on tefillin this morning, and I'm just beyond words. Now, I want to introduce you to a very interesting book. You know the name of the author, Jerome Mintz. And we cited Jerome Mintz, and again, no one has reacted to my request. Who was he? What was he like in his personal life? He died about 20 years ago already. And I can't get any handle on him. Was he a from Jew? I mean, he obviously came from Chassidim. He knows what he's doing. He was a professor in the Midwest. And he wrote two wonderful books on Chassidim. But I'm just curious, in his personal life, where was he? Who was he? There was a conservative rabbi in the 30s, a graduate of the seminary. Maybe that was his father. I believe he also wrote in Chassidim. But I'm curious, who was Jerome Mintz? I tried via the internet, if some of you are experts, try and see if you get more information than a tyro like Rakefet can get. Anyway, he then wrote a second book, much later, Chassidic People.
The one I have.
A Place in the New World.
What's the other one?
The other one is Tales of the Hasidim. Also based upon tales they tell in America. That book came out in 69. 68, 69. This book came out maybe early in 1991, 92, Mashu Kazem. I have a Xerox copy of the second book. So beginning on page 92, he gets into a whole discussion of Chabad. Lubavitch, redeeming fellow Jews, proselytizing the Jewish community, and he begins the chapter, the overriding concern of the Lubavitch Chassidim is to re-educate and realign the non-religious Jewish world to win Jews back to traditional Torah Judaism. And then he discusses the Chabad house. The typical Chabad house is located close to a college with the aim of attracting thoughtful young people interested in studying interpretations of the Holy Scriptures or grappling with the riddles of existence, in quotation marks. But the emissaries also seek out school dropouts, troubled youth, involved with drugs, and those drawn to non-Jewish proselytizing faiths. The Chabad house also serves as a house of worship and study. They supply Hebrew books, phylacteries, mezuzah, and other ritual items. In response to community needs, the emissaries may initiate a variety of services, religious classes for children, seminars, and study groups for students and adults. Each Chabad house is supported by a modest budget allocated by the Brooklyn office and may raise additional funds to support special needs. Now, nowadays, the Brooklyn office, I think it's only the first 2 years that they're going to have that. The level of success or failure varies greatly according to the abilities of the particular emissaries. And that's absolutely true in life. No two of us have the same ability, have the same kochot, have the same intellectual, emotional ability. We're all different. Not all of us are organized. In order to run a Chabad house, you have to be organized. A lot depends on the husband and wife team. And as you know, some shluchim are world famous, some shluchot are world famous. The shluchot just had a conference, so they asked one of the leading shluchot, how many do you have? So she answers 500. So he thought it was only 500 shluchot. She was really answering that we have 500 less than the men. 4,000 shluchim came to their conference a few weeks ago, and 3,500 shluchot. And the reason is some of the shluchot have young children. You can't exactly leave their children with incapable men who don't know how to take care of the young children, etc. I just advised someone yesterday, in this, we spoke about it in class. So I get it, Shem Yerachim, some of the calls I get. But this is a Talmud, as Masar Kedusha, when he got married, I told you yesterday what happened at the wedding. And now that miraculously two children, and his wife wants out, she's was raised in square, with all that that implies, if you understand when I mention the word square chassidim, square town, or what do they call it, new square. In my days it was called square town, but I guess that was a popular appellation. So I told him, you must give a get, don't fight it, the more you fight, the children are going to suffer, they're going to suffer anyway with a divorce. And the more you fight, the worse it is. And I said, and the truth is, do you really want full joint custody? I just saw a Talmud of mine, he gets joint custody, three children, little children, Shabbos, through Friday, through Monday morning, I think he has them every other week. Ich bin ihm nicht mekana. Do I have to translate it? I'm not envious of him. Three little children driving him crazy, he can barely get to shul. You understand, men are not made, with all due respect to the feminist movement, a man will remain a man and a woman will remain a woman, and there's no way we can change the realities of God's creation. Yeah, a grandfather, I'm very good with grandsons who are intelligent and come to me for knowledge. I just helped the grandson prepare a whole paper on Jewish philosophy for Bezalel. And he said to me, imagine I'm doing this paper on just what I'm about to talk about, the machlokes between Chabad and Satma for Bezalel. But it seems the third year, they require them to do a course in Jewish philosophy. They shouldn't be total Amei Haaretz. So my grandson wanted to write, and I told him, this topic is good, write on this because it's of interest, and even a person who only reads Haaretz will understand what you're talking about. So so it depends, and this is not a negative comment, this is a reality of life. I got smicha, a whole group of guys got smicha, if I had any seichel, I'd write a book, the smicha class of 1961 revisited. You follow? But I can't do it because some of it is good, some of it is bad. I don't want to write bad. What can I do? But if I wanted to make money, believe me, a book like that would outsell Washington, would outsell the Rav in 2 days on the market. It would be over the top. So this is reality of life. Now, our good friend Jerome Mintz goes around and asks the Satma Chassid, what do you think of this, what Chabad does? And this is quoting the Satma Chassid now. It's a sociological study. If you know the way sociological studies work, they work with case studies. Case studies are absolutely fascinating because they're real. It's life. If you read George Kranzler, Gershon Kranzler's doctorate, and Morty, you knew Dr. Kranzler, right? Right, so you know who I'm talking about. I knew him well, too. I'm a schmucky here, the Kranzler brothers. They don't make them like that anymore. Those were the kids that came out of Torah Vadas in that period. Torah Vadas had tremendous achievements. You had graduates, Gross, Alexander Gross. Do I have to go further? The problem is that later they couldn't go back to Torah Vadas. All their descendants studied in the greater YU community. So Kranzler's doctorate on Williamsburg, the case studies in back, the second half of the volume, are fabulous. It brings Williamsburg circa 1950s to life. So here he's interviewing this Satma. Quote, we wouldn't put tefillin on just anybody. You have to wash your hands before putting on tefillin. You have to be a religious person. Putting tefillin on a non-religious person is a desecration of tefillin. We're just beginning. They send out people to give candles to a woman to light candles for the Sabbath. We're not even supposed to mix with women. They are not decently dressed, especially in the summer months. You have the Lubavitchers going around the Rose Bowl parades. Remember what I was telling you before? Wherever there's a happening, all the parades in California, it's way out of place. That's where you're going to ask Jews, are you Jewish? Did you put on tefillin? See? Our policy is, even though we are more conservative, we are more liberal. We don't impose our views on any other Jews. We want to live and let live. This interview, it's the 1980s. Summer, the 1980s. More liberal. We don't impose our views. Live and let live.
Yeah, yeah.
Desecration of tefillin. Gentlemen, I'm going to sell you a sauce now. But this sauce, $36,000 linked to the shekel. Who will buy it in honor of Mark? Okay. Put it on the IOU list. Mark, I want you to verify that I'm reading the sauce. Okay? Okay? There are people here who will say the Rebbe is making it up. You just heard a chassid speak. Okay? You just heard a chassid speak. This is the Satmar Rav speaking. Reb Yoel Teitelbaum. And this is, if you're not familiar with this, I'm introducing you to it's a gift to know this. This is Kuntres Al HaGula V'Al HaTemura. Me'et Ad Moreinu Moreinu Rabbeinu HaKohen HaKodesh Maran Reb Yoel Teitelbaum Shlita Av Beitin Dekhila Kedoshla Satma. Alex, are you familiar with this? When was this written? So here's the story. Well, I'll fill you in. You can't, there's nothing to guess here. The Sakhmurov was, you know, again, we've spoken about this, if not this year, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Sakhmurov's life was saved by the Kastner train. Now, the Kastner train remains a point of controversy until today. Was Kastner a tzaddik or a rasha? Truth is, he was somewhere in the middle, but his granddaughter, by the way, is a Chaverat Knesset, I believe, from the Mapai, from Herzog's party. It's his granddaughter. Kastner saved Jews. They know two ways about it. On the other hand, he had to make choices, and he had to negotiate with Himmler, and I believe Eichmann was involved. You can check it out. A lot has been written. There's movies, there are documentaries. When you get involved in making choices like that, you cannot win, because you can never make only good choices. People are going to be angry at you. Why didn't you save my mother, my cousin? Why this rabbi? Why not that rabbi? He saved the Sakhmurov. How the Sakhmurov got saved remains an open question. It was explained at some yahrzeit with Kastner, so I heard a whole discussion, the Noah Ark theory. You know what I'm talking about? That Kastner made a decision, he's going to save two of each animal, so that the Jews who resuscitate themselves after the Holocaust will resemble what the Jewish population was like before. So he chose some Hasidic Rebbeim that they should be Hasidim after the Holocaust. That's the Noah Ark theory. The Hasidim tell a story that one of the people involved in the negotiations had a dream, or Kastner had a dream, and his grandmother appeared to him, or his mother appeared to him in the dream, and told him, you must save that great rabbi. And that's how Rabbi Yoelish got on the train. All right. So you might think, if you're saved by the Jewish agency, which was behind Kastner, you're going to be makat toiva to the Zionist movement. But Rabbi Yoel became the biggest opponent of the Zionist movement, that you all know. Satmar gives birth to a certain degree to Natura Kata. It's from the point of view of the State of Israel, a sad story. All right, now, the Satmar Rav wrote a tremendous volume, Vayol Moshe. I explained to my grandson, Vayol Moshe is a play on Yitro, Vayol Moshe L'shevet in Yitro Chatno, that Vayol, it's good to sit in Chutz La'aretz, Chas V'Chalil, you should go in Aliyah. The volume has three big divisions. In this volume, Rabbi Yoel comes out against the Pesach of the Rambam, that it's better to live in Israel where it's Kulo Goyim than to live in Chutz La'aretz where it's Kulo Yisraelim. And he explains that's only if the Jews, the few that are there, are religious. But you go to Israel today, you'll be swept away, no religion, no nothing, Chas V'Chalila to go. Then he goes into the three oaths, tremendous. That's the first section where he deals with the Gemara in Ketuvah, Daf Kutyuv Aleph Amid Aleph. Hishpati etchem benot Yerushalayim, shalo yedul b'chomash, lo yudu keneged umot olam. And then they make the nations of the world swear, shalo yishtabdu b'Yisrael yotem midai. And then he goes into a whole discourse against speaking Hebrew. Chas v'chalila, Hebrew is a holy language. It cannot be used for profane daily speech. And Satm is raised on this. I can tell you a student of mine, Per Herzog today, once got a job teaching English in a Satma school, a Satma high school, and she couldn't get the kids to come to water, and she used the word sheket. And the class was in a deadly silence, and Apikoros used the Hebrew word. How would you allow? She had to say shtils, shtar shtils, silent, but to use the word sheket. So this Vayol Moshe was, of course, the famous Satmar treatise. And as Satmar started to resuscitate itself in the late 50s into the 60s, this was their Bible. Just as Chabadnikim look up to the Tanya, Satmar looked up Vayol Moshe. This was their framework. Then came the Six-Day War. The Six-Day War was a tremendous shock. It happened very slowly. In other words, had it happened within a minute, you wouldn't have time to think. But remember, NASA moved the troops into Sinai on Yom HaTzmut. There were 3 weeks till the war broke out. And the whole world was, Russia and the UN and the Arab countries were licking their chops, will soon be rid of the Jewish people. And there was a tremendous frightening pachad in the world, and there were 3 weeks to stew in it. By the way, this pachad gave birth to the return of the Russian Jews to the Jewish people. And that was explained to me in Russia, that the TV, when we worked for the Mossad, the TV was state-controlled. It was something to watch. And the broadcasters who worked for the Russian television, they would, at night, you'd hear the news, and then they would have the military analysts speak, and they had endless medals on. You could see which side they were on. These people were not neutral. So before the Six-Day War, and by the way, everyone in Russia was encouraged to get a TV. It was a very poor economy, but where you worked, you got a loan of 100 ruble payable back over 100 years. They wanted a television in every comrade's house. Why? Exactly, indoctrination. Political indoctrination. They would show, Malkin, I'd be hysterical, you didn't have to understand Russian, they would show the mother of the day, a woman with 10 children living in Siberia, working for the state, the corporate state, the individual doesn't count, the indoctrination, beautiful. How many believed it? Among the Jews, there were some, but few. Among the Gentiles, I think there were even fewer than among the Jews, actually. That's the truth. I don't want to go into even Lenin that was partially Jewish. It's unbelievable. Frankl was Jewish. Of course, Marx was totally a scion of Gedolei Yisrael, his grandfather, etc. Rotsfarm. Look up Marx, you'll see. You'll get all the names you want. Go to the Wikipedia. So they would watch the television and explain, and you know, they would show the Jewish kids digging trenches in Jerusalem, yeshiva boys, Beis Yaakov girls, Geula, right beyond Geula, the border with Jordan, and the announcer
would speak in terms that soon they'll all be destroyed by the Arabs. And the Jews in Russia watching weren't listening to the announcer, but they saw these kids, their cousins, their relatives, their people, and it awakened within them a feeling that communism until then had totally negated that were part of Am Yisrael. So that's why I always tell people, it's quoted, requoted, Baruch Hashem, I've said something smart in my life. I always say when I would begin a lecture in the army to catch the attention of the soldiers, I would begin when I come home after this lecture, I will kiss the mezuzah, the television, and my wife. And everyone would pop forward, what's going on? And then I would explain that the mezuzah you understand, the wife you understand. Ah, the television. And that was my springboard into the concept of Yachid V'Klal, everything I got from Moriah Rebbe. So you should know that I saw with my own eyes Satma Hasidim walking up and down the subways in New York collecting money for the war effort for the state of Israel. So there was a big shock in Satma that youth are raising questions. Israel, miracles, what God did. So the Rebbe wrote a kuntres. He was the first one to publish a sefer about the Six-Day War. It came out in 67. Kuntres al ha-Geula v'al ha-Temura. Again, an ingenious play and words. Giddy, do you know where that pasuk comes from? V'zot lifnim b'Yisrael l'kayim kol davar al ha-Geula v'al ha-Temura v'shalafi shet nahalo sefer rut. That this was the minhag before. You with me, Murray? To fulfill anything in Israel, to show you're obligated, al ha-ge'ula, when you redeem something, al ha-tamura, when you exchange something. So then, kinyan chalipin, v'shalat ishet nalo. The Satma Rebbe here, Mori, was ingenious. Al ha-ge'ula, the al ha-tamura, the real redemption, and the phony redemption. Could you imagine that play on words? The real redemption and the phony redemption. Wow. And that's the Satma Rebbe's language. Now, I just want to see if I have everyone down here, anyone who needs credit. One second. This is Sunday's class. Rafi, I don't see your name here. Is it possible? Do you need credit for this class?
I guess so, yeah. I'll go check with them.
Okay, go check. One second. Let me just add your name. Because they keep on bothering the office with credit. When the person's ready to get smicha, they suddenly realize they never signed in. If I don't have the name here, then it doesn't reach the office. Okay, ala gula v'ala tamura. And this is the Satmar Rav wrote after the Six-Day War. Now, in this volume, he asked going to the Koto, going to Marat HaMachpelah, going to Kever Rachel. I mean, he asked conquered by Tzahal. Tzahal is the actions of the Sitra Mavuta. And in this volume, he is, by the way, later in Lubavitcher, two tremendous refutations come out against this volume. One was written by Rabbi Nachum Kasher. I don't want to go into more details, it'll take the whole hour. Rabbi Nachum Kasher, Torah Shleima, the great Gerer Chassid, Gaon Adir, he wrote a tremendous refutation, both of the first Sefer, HaTkufa HaGadola, and both after this came out, he wrote, after the Yom Kippur War, another Sefer that deals with this and deals with the Yom Kippur War. In addition, in Chabad, Rabbi Yoel Cohn, the Jose of the Rebbe, who's also a Gaon Adir with an absolute photographic memory, he wrote a Sefer, which was recently published. I think Chaim Dorfman published it.
a fabulous sefer refuting the Rebbe as well on this level. But coming back to 67, you have to understand what happened here. The Kotel was conquered and brought into Jewish hands. Har Habayit B'Yodeinu, whatever that means, Baruch HaGur, the paratroopers, all that went with it. In Israel, we had a lot more secularists then than we have today. Today, we still have B'nai Korach Lo Meitu, to paraphrase the Medrash, it's a rabbinic aphorism. We have people, you know what's going on with the cult, or with the women of the cult, or with the Reformed Jews. Suddenly the Reformed Jews are interested in the cult. Believe me, it's a miracle. So we have opposition, but it's not percentage-wise what you had in 67. 67, you had Mapam. You had real, powerful political party that was totally opposed. And now you have the cult back. They wanted to turn the Kotel into a public theater, into an archaeological find. And here I want to tell you something very interesting. You take the Israeli Museum. The Israeli Museum is probably, percentage-wise, we have the finest museum in the world. For a country of our size, to have a museum on that level, we're not America, we're not Russia, it's not the Hermitage. We didn't rob, but the Hermitage is a big shy if you're allowed to look at what they have on display, because 70 or 80% was nationalized by the communists against the will of the people when they took over, right or wrong, just think. So if you had a Rembrandt, it belongs to the people, it belongs to the state, not to the individual. But the Israeli Museum is quite an achievement. Now, on when it comes to Judaica, it's probably the top museum in the world. And you see on display Sifrei Torah, shuls. I mean, it's amazing. You have various different shuls that were brought over from various different countries. You have tefillin, mezuzah, no end to what you have on display. So you see, tell me, did Teddy Kolak, who built the museum, and he deserves all the credit, he was the legendary mayor of Jerusalem, they just declared his house on the Chov Rashbat, around the corner from you, they just declared it a national home, they can't revise it, Binyan Shamur, historic building. Nothing great about the building, but Kolak lived there for many, many decades. His children were raised there. Tell me, did Kolak put tefillin on them in the morning? Absolutely not. And don't let any Chabadnik tell me off that, yes, he put on tefillin. He didn't put on tefillin. But you see, in a museum, he has tefillin. That's the attitude they wanted, that archaeologically, you have the cult now, so it's like ancient tefillin. You'll see where the Mizbeach was, where the Har Habayit was, you'll have displays, you'll have lectures, but it's not going to be a Makom Kodesh. Okay? Now, what happened at the Kotel? People were in a state of trance, a state of shock. No one knew what to do. Had we knocked down the old city then, we would have an entirely different situation today. But we didn't think. What we did do, around the Kotel, we plowed away all the houses that were nearby, and the Kotel was a little area, and we developed that big public meeting place, call it what you wish, which we have today. Thank God we have it. What do you do with the area? The Kotel was open to the public on Shavuot of 1967. Shavuot of 1967, everyone was allowed to go to the Kotel. Hundreds of thousands of Jews poured into Jerusalem. They camped out. It was beautiful weather in the park, the Independence Park, right behind the Plaza Hotel. Tents were set up. Thousands and thousands of Jews camped out. They walked in. I believe you went in through Shar Yafo or Shar Tzion, and you came out through the Damascus Gate. Paratroopers were all over the place. The Arabs were scared stiff. It's not like today. And the Kotel is now open to the public. The next day, the Rebbe gave the order. Chabad got to the Kotel, and they started putting tefillin on. That's how it all began. The tefillin campaign that began during this 3 weeks of waiting when Chabadikim asked the Rebbe what to do, so he told them that from Kfar Chabad they should send out shluchim wherever the troops are stationed, and they should see that as many chayalim as possible will put on tefillin. Rafi, what's so important about tefillin? V'rol ka'ami ha'aretz ki shem Hashem nikra alecha v'yarum mimecha. And they'll fear you, they'll fear you. The more soldiers who put on tefillin, the more the Arabs will be afraid we will win in battle. Now the war is over. The troops have come back. It was a very quick war, 6 days. They immediately put up tefillin stands at the Kotel. And I want to tell you, in retrospect, there's no doubt in my mind that those tefillin stands helped influence the public opinion that the Kotel has to be a place of worship. It's not an archaeological place, but it's a place of worship, a magnet. The rest is history, I need not tell you. Millions and millions, tens, 20, 30, 40 million Jews, if you add together how many times have visited the Kotel from the entire world, what the Kotel has become for us, to a certain degree, it is like a shrine. I hate to use that word because it has Christological implications, but it's mamish, a shrine. And like I mentioned Jackie Gluck before, he already put me on notice that his grandson is being bar mitzvah at the Kotel right after Pesach, etc., etc. So I told him, if I'm not teaching, it's a Monday morning, but I don't believe I'm teaching. I said, if I'm not teaching, I'm there for the bar mitzvah. If I'm teaching, teaching always has to come first, particularly today, when a handful is sitting in front of me and thousands upon thousands are listening. And it's not a bluff, because I cannot tell you, I will not show you the emails that come into YU about the Shayur. So, I nimodela kadosh baruch hu. Okay. All right. The Satmu Ruv went crazy against the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And here's what he wrote. Alex, I apologize, but it's the Satmu Ruv speaking. You have to have...
I have a lot of respect for the Satmar.
No, no, but you have to have intellectual curiosity not to get upset.
No, I don't know.
Okay.
I've heard it.
You've heard it before. Page 104. When I quote this, people don't believe me. I know it by heart, actually, but I just want to show you I'm reading it, that you shouldn't think I'm just making it up, because it's... Unless, now that you heard my introduction, at least... You follow me, Jason? At least you can appreciate what I'm quoting. But otherwise, it's... Wow. Bavanotenu Harabin, he's writing about the Lubavitcher Rebbe, he says, with a multitude of sins, we find among us Yirei Hashem, who don't understand the sins that Jewish people have. And they're going to reach out and put tefillin on Jews who are not religious? This is terrible. This is the Sitra Mavuta, whatever that means, the bad side of God, the Satan is inciting them to do this. Why? Aval Elu HaRishayim, the Jews in Israel who are not from, calls them Rishayim. Shekol machshvotam v'iskam b'arayet rachman alitzlan. That all their thinking and their activities are involved with licentious sexual behavior. Umezuhamim b'tachlet hazuhamah. And are filthy with the worst type of filth that can enter the body of a human being. V'kol megamatam, their entire goal in life, l'mam rabot sima, is to increase their indecorous sexual activity. V'lachein himtziu gius hanashim, this is why they draft women into the army. Liot mufkarim, to have women who are hefka, satisfy their sexual needs, kgruim sheba umat, like the lowest of the lowest of the nations of the world. These type of Jews, asulahem, alpidin, lahaniach tfilin. they are not allowed to put on tefillin. It's like you come and say, Yeshayla Rebbe, my mind is totally filled with insects, with sex. I want to rape this woman and that woman. Can I put on tefillin? The answer is no. To put on tefillin, you have to have a mind that's at least concentrated on good, on kedusha, on tefillah, what you're doing. Absolutely forbidden. Valkeina tan lechem ha-sitra ma-vusa etza machshava l'ramot b'mitzvah tefillin shebezu atzma mosifin aveda basiyata umagdilin koach ha-sitra ma-vusa. And these people think you're going to do a mitzvah. You're going to get Jews to put on tefillin. Not only is it not a mitzvah, it's a sin. Not only is it a sin, but you're increasing the power, the strength of the sitra mavuta, the bad side of God, the negative side, the satan. Wow. What a caustic attack. And now you can understand the Satma being interviewed. He says, we're liberal. We don't force our view upon anybody else. Now, I have to tell you, with all due respect to what the Satma Ruv wrote, I've seen Jews put on tefillin at the Kotel. I guarantee you 99.99% their thoughts are good. I told you, my Uncle Max... Remember, I have grandparents. I wasn't born on a tree. My mother comes from a family of 6 children. Due to the miracle of the fact that she chose to put me into Yeshiva Salanta, second grade, my mother died with on to 50 great-grandchildren, Kulam Shomrei Torah Mitzvot. That's about 10 times more than all her 5 siblings put together have Jewish grandchildren. Okay? And mind you, my grandmother was a cousin to Rabbi Revel, and my grandfather learned in Volozh and could quote Gemaras by heart. So think, you know what America is. My Uncle Max, till his dying day, boasted he put on tefillin twice on his life, his bar mitzvah and at the kotel, and he was always makir toive to the chabadnik who put on at the kotel. I've seen people at the Kotel crying, they put tefillin on. I've seen them saying Shema Yisrael, and then the Chabadnik translates into English, and they're transformed. Can't understand the Satmar Rafi. It's way out. Hard for me, as much as I want to be liberal and not be negative, and be pluralistic in the Torah world, you know my viewpoint. But wow, but this is Satma, and I can't get over that Satma Chassid being interviewed, how he's boasting, oh yeah, we are open-minded, we are not like the Lubavitcher, we are live and let live, we are liberal, okay, but that's not Lubavitch. Lubavitch's response to such disdain is to point out the need to love one's fellow Jew as well. This is the Lubavitcher speaking now. Quote, if we know of something we have, the responsibility rests upon us to inform other Jews of it. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, referring to early texts, contends that there is no man so wicked that he cannot put on tefillin, adding that there is divine joy when a person dons the tefillin, even if he has never done so before. That's the Rebbe in the Sikha responding to Talagula Val HaTemura. And all right, this is Chabad. This is not judgmental. This is the outreach. Then he goes to Bavav. And you see, if you know Bavav, it's fascinating. They also resuscitate them and say that because they're basically limited to America. Although they're interrelated, Bava relates to sons and the Halberstam family They're interrelated. But Bava basically resuscitated itself with miracles. As far as I understand, the Bava Rebbe, the one survivor when he came to America, came clean shaven, and he went into business, and he was not interested in being a Rebbe. And the Hasidim, Reb Shlomo, I believe, the Hasidim pleaded with him that they need a Rebbe. He has the blood in him. And he built Bava, tremendous Abbat Yisrael, the tradition Slavon, and I've gone into Bava in Borough Park when I finished davening, because I daven early, made Kiddush, my wife and I went for a walk. So I think I told you over the years, it's not decades, that we once came to Bava on Shabbos, 47th Street, and police cars are parked outside, and we asked, what's going on here? We asked the police lady, what are you doing here? She said, what, you don't know? They were throwing chairs, an Italian lady, they were throwing chairs at each other with here in case the ruckus breaks out again. We're on the spot, the Shabbos. And they split in half now, but this is the third generation. The second generation, I believe it was Reb Naftali, didn't live long. He didn't succeed at his father, but not by that much. But they asked this Bava V'chassad what he thinks. In the first place, it's not such a good idea to have contact with such people. It's too risky. In other words, he's worried he's going to have contact with irreligious people that will rub off on him. In the second place, these people are not always well balanced. So evidently the interviewer looked at him. What do you mean not well balanced? I mean they're good people, but awful they're troubled. This is a difficult life. And one really has to be born into it. You see the difference? I would never speak this way. I have my Divrei Torah on the from Mori Rebbe on the embryo, the Gemara Nida, the embryo learning with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with the angel. No, what does that mean? And then they touch your lip and you forget it all. Well, if you forget it all, why did the angel waste his time teaching you? But it shows that every Jew has the ability within him, it's inborn, that you can be a Ben Torah, you can observe, you can know Torah. And he says, we take in some Baal Tshubas too in Bavav, but we don't go looking for them. And that's the difference between Bavav, Chabad, and Satma. Now, I do want to add as a postscript that 20 years later, remember, we're way beyond when this book was written, Chabad has had big influence, and Bavav today is much more open. Bells is dealing with Balei Tshuva. There is one tremendous difference. Chabad reaches out to every Jew, Bahashem Hosham. Bells, essentially, is trying to reach out to those who have Bell's blood within them to bring back the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren. They're not on every street corner, but if you come into Bell's and you mention, my Alta Zayda was a Bell's Chassid, and you're seeking your roots and who you come from, you're going to find a very welcoming hand in Bell's. Bavav, in general, has been so successful in America, low key. It's not a loud Hasidus and not an extreme Hasidus, and their positions on public stands. You're not going to see the Bava Rebbe dancing at a Good at Israel conventions or dancing at Mizrahi conventions, but they're welcoming to everybody, and they also have picked up Balei Tshuva who want a Hasidic way of life. I can tell you when I walked into Bavav, Shabbos morning, immediately I was accosted on the outside. People come out. Did you daven yet? They welcome me. It's like Jackie Gluck with that Israeli in Bell Harbor. And then we started to talk, and it turns out the guy, I taught his cousins, and then he knew exactly who I was and where I was coming from. And wow, his whole demeanor and deportment changed. It's not a total outsider walking in. This is an insider looking at us. We're the outsiders. It was a whole different experience. But Lubavitch has certainly influenced the entire world. And you take YU Torah Leadership Seminars, which you don't even know about. That was a direct output from Lubavitch. Where did YU learn about it? Whoever spoke in my time outreach, whoever heard of outreach. I mean, the Litvisher Rashi Yeshiva, Rav Noach Bornstein, Rav Yeruchim Gerelek, who were laughing, were hysterical. What? Outreach, smoutreach, who was? Goyim, all right, they're not talking like the Sofna Rebbe. But they weren't that far away. And then you take NCSY, which is one of the most successful outreach programs in the world. You have to give tremendous credit to NCSY. I know all the decades I've taught, some of my best students were products of NCSY. That too comes from Lubavitch. Now, this book by Mintz goes on, and he interviews people who were affected by Lubavitch. And here we come to a very important point. When you're involved in outreach, sometimes you have no impact at the moment, but the seeds are planted. Later in life, that person wakes up. Whatever the experience is, something has happened, he starts to question. Because you implanted the seeds, that person will blossom into a totally observant Jew. You'll see in a minute, I'll quote some interviews. Then there's another side to the coin, which anyone writing about Chabad today alludes to. Chabad is all over the place. YU graduates, and I assume there's a lot of good in YU. I saw some of the downside of YU in Florida, but I assume there's a lot of good as well today. I heard the downside maledicting the blackies in YU. So if they're blackies, if they're whiteies in YU maledicting the blackies, it shows there are blackies in YU. And I assume the blackies are into learning and davening, and they put on tefillin every day. And you know, Rakef, it's but if to remain from a good slaritz, you need a black hat, you should wear two black hats. I'm not opposed. Let Barcelona make a fortune with any of us. Okay. Excuse me?
They're bankrupt.
They're bankrupt, so whoever get the, wherever they get the black hats today, someone is producing them. So I saw the downside. But a lot of the YU top graduates don't want to go into the rabbinate. They go into being Malamdin, being Rashi Yeshiva, being teachers, the day school system, principals, chinuch. They go into outreach, but they don't go into the rabbinate. You see, Chabad is all over the place today in the rabbinate. We'll come to it next week, I hope, with Europe.
You're talking about shul?
Regular shul, exactly. Yeah. Regular shuls. In America, then it's a minority that's in regular shuls, like Rabbi Edelman. I spoke about Rabbi Edelman of Deerfield Beach. So there are probably a number of others that have big kihilot where they're regular rabbis. The fact that they're Chabadnikim is a plus to their rabbinate, but it's not the heart of the rabbinate. In America, you have Chabad all over. In Europe, who wants to go to Europe? Who's willing to live in Europe? Who's willing to sacrifice in Europe? Take China. Take the OU, the Hashgacha. There were Rashi Yeshiva in YU that I argued with in this very base medrash. It must be 10 years ago. They wanted Asa Chabad. And I was arguing with them. I don't want to waste time now repeating what they said, what they think of Chabad. I mean, Ribbono Shel Olam, not every Chabadnik is a messianist. If you ask me in my years on the earth, if I would pick anyone who could have been Mashiach, it's the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I say it openly. I can prove it 1,000 ways over. I get open Gemara, I can quote Torah from the Rav. Could have been in every generation. It's an open Gemara in Sanhedrin and the Rambam. The Rav is Madaik in two Rambams. In every generation, there's someone who could be. But all right, lo zechino, we're not yet there. God has his own plan. But to Asa Chabad, anyway, when they got back to New York, suddenly I hear the whole plan to Asa Chabad from YU, it fell through. So I figured, wow, did I have so much influence? What are you talking about? A nechta ketag, it had nothing to do with Rakefet. It had to do with Rabbi Menachem Ganek, who told his colleagues, look, if you want a Rasa Chabad, I got to close the OU Hashgacha down. Plain and simple. Are you willing to go to Thailand? You willing to go to China? So you see Chabad all over the place. Now, this is fabulous, but there's a downside. What's the downside? Very simple. No, they have kihilot, they have congregants. They try to influence.
how many Jews do they really turn into total Jews? See, and this leaves you with a very interesting question. You get a guy to put on tefillin. Fine, he's putting on tefillin. Shabbos, he got to watch the football game of the week, Shabbos afternoon, right? There's a big game. Have we won? Have we lost? Go back to what I said an hour ago. Jackie Gluck goes into the shul and sits down. He told it to me, and Jackie was so upset. You know, to him it was an eye-opener. He was coming from Whitmer, where he helped build the Young Israel of Whitmer, which I think has the largest membership of any Young Israel in the world. Maybe Staten Island is bigger. I don't know. Maybe Deerfield Beach is bigger. The Young Israel of Whitmer. Everyone is Shomer Shabbos there. Thousands of people, endless minyanim on Shabbos. Endless minyanim. All right, not all at tzaddikim. Again, I saw a lot of whiteys there. I remember the talking during the davening. It was like Yankee Stadium. That's how, when DiMaggio hit a homer, there was less noise than there was at Woodmere and in Musaf. And that's how my Talmud, the Mashpia of the yeshiva, that's how Eish Kodesh began. To join Eish Kodesh, you have to sign a pledge that you will not talk during davening. I think the Yisrael got better as a result. But, fine. This guy is coming with a black hat, with a gatel, and he's driving the shul on Shabbos. All right, now let's take another case. You'll see this is all real. Take another case. This guy got taken in by Kampad, and he says Shomer Shabbos, and he's happy, and it's meaningful. But his wife, and she's heard so many lectures, she can't go to mikveh. It's not for her. Not for her. And by the way, mikveh is a very delicate subject. One of the great things happening in Israel today, it's through Tzohar, now it's through the Misrat HaDatot, they have given classes now to mikveh ladies, how to deal with women who come to mikveh. Yeah, it's a very delicate question. A Chabadnikit would know how to deal with them, by the way. But people who are not Chabad, a lady comes there, Mechalelet Shabbos, but she's of Eidot HaMizrach, where the mikveh, there more mikveh goers in Eidot HaMizrach than there are Shomrat Shabbat. Maybe it's not true today, but it certainly was true 20, 30, 40 years ago. When I first came in Aliyah, it was a real culture shock for me, 50 years ago. They had a real feeling for mikveh. It was like, if you want a good fair, and there's a lot of truth to it, I don't have to quote the Gemara to you, and neither. In our day and age, if you're a guy, you should also go to mikveh. It would add to marriages and the tragedies. We wouldn't have so many tragedies. So the woman doesn't want to go to mikveh. So now, how do you view this? You see, here too, it's a very delicate question. How do you view this? You can take one approach, you know, and I'm inclined. What the heck did I accomplish? Nachem Achalos Shabbos, Akum Davening Shabbos, Tutan Tefillin. What did I accomplish? No, there's Shomrei Shabbos. Zigeit Nishtim Mikvah. I'm gonna have a big problem now when one of you want to marry their daughters and you say to me it's a bat nida. Pagum, the halacha, all right? I've spoken about this. In my new book, you'll see, it's all there. The one that's coming out. Okay? So, you see, is this an achievement? Absolutely. When you view it through the eyes of Chabad, every Jew who does more mitzvot, that is an achievement. And you know something? They're absolutely right. Look into the Rambam Hilchot Shuva. What do you see? The world is half and half. Every good deed you do weighs it more positively. So, see, these are problems. You can't say you're going to win them all. A human being by nature. We're living in the Western world. We have such tremendous challenge to religion. Right now, I think I mentioned in class, if not I mentioned in private conversation, last week, the administrator of the European Radnet, I believe it is, spoke out, and he said openly that at what, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, the overwhelming majority of European people believed in God. Religion mattered. Today, the churches are empty. This is true of America, too. Outside of the Bible Belt, the churches are empty. Who believes in God? To believe in man, all of ethics, man-centered. And these are real problems, and people are caught up in this big world, and you're not going to succeed entirely, but you succeed partially. Eliezeri makes the point, David Eliezeri, Rabbi Eliezeri, who's a Chabad, a Shaluach, par excellence, world famous now, he's in the Jewish Agency Board of Trustees, and his book is very, very popular, cited, recited, and it is a fabulous book on Chabad, and it's inner core, it's inner motion, it's inner movement, it's inner ideas. So he makes a very interesting point, that what you have developing in the rabbinate, you have some Orthodox Jews that are non-Chabad, and there the overwhelming majority of the members are totally Shomer Shabbos. But then you have other shuls where Chabad is reaching out, so you have Shomrei Shabbos, and you have a traditional core, that they're not total, but they're a lot more than what they were before. And that is extremely positive. Apropos of this volume by Eliezeri, I can tell you, B'didi HaViyukta, it happened to me. When Rabbi Moshe Kripke was working in the OU, so he used to activate me. He was my student, a virtual student. He's a great individual. And he got bumped with the Lannis scandal. They had to get rid of anyone who was in the OU, and they had absolutely nothing to do with the Lannis scandal, but why didn't they fire him? Well, it's a sad story. I know the inner workings, which I cannot reveal, but it's a sad story. Because the OU, I don't think, has ever resuscitated itself. When Rabbi Butler was there, you had a dominant personality who was a tremendous Hatzlacha. Halavai, I'm not in America, I can't say I know everything, but Halavai, they should resuscitate themselves 100% plus. So Rabbi Kripke, Rabbi Moshe Kripke used to activate me. So one time he calls me, he wants me, there's the General Assembly of the Jewish Agency, the Jews who are committed, who come from all over the world, and he wants me, there's a slot for an Orthodox rabbi, because in every hotel, this hotel has an Orthodox rabbi, this hotel a conservative rabbi, a reform rabbi, and sometimes the hotel has all three. And here I am in the Hyatt Hotel, I have the Orthodox slot. And it was I don't want to go into more detail, it was a very difficult Shabbos, because I'm a couple of Shabbos, Shabbat began, it was November, 4:35, and the meal is at 7, and I'm walking to the meal, and the reform of first finishing, and hundreds of ladies are lighting Shabbos candles 2.5 hours into Shabbat. Wow. So at the meal, this person from the Jewish Agency gets up to speak, and he says, I'm very happy to see that we have all the streams of Judaism represented here. Dr. Rakefet representing the Orthodox. Then he gives a name representing Chabad. Then he gives a name representing conservative. Then he gives another name representing reforms. I said, that Chabad guy, I never knew that we're in two different ballparks. But if you look at David Eliezeri's book, it does make sense, in the sense, a guy like yours truly, I'm not going to be happy, I'm going to be upset. A Chabadnik, no, this is the reality. Some I reached partway, some I reached full way. Now, here are interviews, I can't finish this today, but here are interviews, very fascinating. I'm beginning on page 94 now. These are people who were affected by Chabad. My religious feeling was mild and not an important part of my life until the revelation of the Holocaust in 1945. Now, what does he mean by revelation of the Holocaust? We never knew the full story. The State Department hid it. Roosevelt, Shem Lashem, Yerkov, Yimach Shmo, Vizikro. These people, they're not enemies of the Jews, but they didn't give a damn. But they didn't lift a finger. What they could have saved, Roosevelt, okay? So then the revelation came. Obviously, some people already knew during World War II, Bergson, the Chayrut group, etc. But the masses of Jews, we had no idea. Everyone thought, you know, people survived, there were some pogroms, how bad was it? The revelation created such rage and fear in my soul and such grief for my poor brothers and sisters. I could have easily been one of them. My grandparents had come over just 40 years before. Providence had put me in the Bronx instead of Babi Yar. That's when being Jewish became very important. And that description could be me speaking. In other words, my family came to America a drop before, a few years before 1905. He says 40 years, so 45 minus 40 is 1905. In my case, it's a few years earlier. Then 3 years after, in 1948, on top of all this, the miracle of the humiliated, despised, contemptible Jews beating back the Arabs and creating Israel made me exceed in my mind at least that something supernatural was happening in history. God was revealing himself more clearly than in a long time. Watch, it's very fascinating. Then I got married in 1956. Yom Kippur, 1957. I felt a terrible need to participate in the ritual, but I didn't know what to do. I said to myself that the days of religious observance are gone. Who in his right mind, who wasn't superstitious, could follow all those rituals, keeping kosher, Yom Kippur, and all the rest? Yet I still felt that terrible longing. So the evening right before Yom Kippur, I took a shower. I shaved very carefully. I shined my shoes and dressed up in my best suit and sat in my living room until it was time to go to sleep. No television, no radio. I just sat and thought, God knows what I was doing. I didn't know what to do. I didn't act on my pulses until a few years later. So you see, it's a good description. When you read it, see, he shaved in honor of Yom Kippur, a Chabadnik, just the opposite. How can you shave? He shines his shoes. You're not allowed to wear shoes on Yom Kippur. But you see, a person like this, when Chabad gets hold of him, not only Chabad, I believe if any of us got hold of him and showed him the rhyme and reason, the Torah Tashim Tamima, this person becomes a total from Jew. He's questioning. He's seeking. He is a success story. I'm going to end off with this story, which is fabulous. These are stories that you can sit around the table and discuss incessantly. I once had some chashuva guests over on a Saturday night, and I read a story that appeared in Jewish Observer that was quoted at the Agudat Yisrael convention, the late Jewish Observer. Do you yet know, Alex, what Jewish Observer was? You don't know. That was the official publication of Agudat Yisrael in America. It was a high-class magazine, came out once a month, with the English versions, Mishpacha and Ami and all the Israeli newspapers in English. Jewish Observer disappeared, but none of these other newspapers, including Mishpacha and Ami, don't equal. Jewish Observer was like Jewish Action. Jewish Action was founded to emulate Jewish Observer. It survives, Jewish Observer is gone. So there was an article there, a Rosh Yeshiva, you know, Rosh Yeshiva, and they're driving him, and he spoke in this shul, and then he spoke at a parlor meeting, and his Talmidim are driving him, and they leave his wife behind. They follow me, Rebbe, how are you? Coming to the car with you? We have to take you. And his wife is left behind. And then they came back after they had driven away three blocks. They turned around and came back to pick her up. And she let the Rosh Yeshiva have it. And the whole discussion, did she do the right thing? Do you justify the Rosh Yeshiva? The students hearing this,
We discussed it endlessly that night. A lot to discuss here.
Maybe she rebuked him in front of the students.
Yeah, right. She was furious. They came back and to Lifa. Listen to this story. I was a graduate student at NYU, and the Chabad mitzvah tank was parked in front of the education building. This was in the early 70s. As I passed by, one of those black coats said to me, "Are you Jewish?" I said, "Of course." "Did you put on tefillin today?" I answered, "I never put on tefillin in my life." He says, "Come into the truck, we'll put on tefillin." He wrapped it around my arm, put it on my head. I repeated the blessings after him. He gave me a metal candlestick for my daughter and a leaflet about the minimum Jewish library I should have and how my wife should bless the Sabbath candles. Before I was finished with my tefillin, a guy came in, and just before they were going to wind the straps around his arm, one of them said to the guy, "Are you really Jewish?" You know, he probably looked like Italiana, an Irishman. He answered him, "No, but I really want to learn about this stuff." And they answered, "Get the heck out of this truck. No grace whatsoever." And he said, "No, but I really want to learn about this." And they said, "You're not Jewish. Get out of the truck." This was an emotional dissonance with my American values that sympathized with economical values. But on the other hand, I liked it. I liked that they kicked him out. They were very forthright. They weren't smooth. They had to do mitzvot and not worry about getting along with goyim. I thought it was very refreshing, but I also felt bad for the guy. He might have made a good convert to Judaism. And we'll continue. This is one part of this interview. You'll see what happens with this guy.
I imagine today that they probably would have given him the Noahide.
Right. You're absolutely right, Alex. But it troubles me. I mean, I can't... You see, on one hand, it's an amazing story. This kid is in postgraduate school, obviously, at NYU. It's downtown NYU, big campus. The mitzvah mobile is parked outside. Are you Jewish? Absolutely. "Did you put on tefillin?" "I never put on tefillin in my life." And the black coat invites him in. He comes in, he puts on the tefillin, and he sees this display of Jewish arrogance. Which Jew was arrogant growing up? I write about it in Washington. We didn't lift a finger. Who ever thought of beating the hell out of an Irish kid or an Italian kid when they beat you up? And here, this kid sees the Chabadnikim. This isn't the Israeli army. And then they tell this guy out. Okay. So let me read it right. All right, we did a world of, I trust, insightful thinking today. It's not a class that you can walk away and just forget. It's a lot to think about. And non-judgmental, the stories I tell with Jackie Gluck, those are two fabulous stories. And I hope Jack is listening, or someone in the Bal Harbor, I know I have people listening there, tell Jackie, I quoted his two stories. But it's food for thought. And Chabad, non-judgmental. Very different than the Baal Tanya. It goes back to the Baal Tanya. But today I'll even accept what Alex says, even to Gentiles, non-judgmental. And as Alex said, I thought of that. That today they would give him the pamphlet on Seven Mitzvah. What would you do if the guy comes back and he says, "I want to do more. It's not enough to Sheva Mitzvah." See, then you get involved in the whole problem of Geirat. And you have to say to the guy, "Are you crazy? Are you insane? Why do you want to be part?" You know, the Gemara in the Bama Dafim Zayin, Dafim Fabam Zbetman, Zayin Mumad Allah, you have to discourage him. But if he comes back a third time, you better open your arms to him and receive him with love and warmth and put him on the derech. And that's what I'll show you in a second. So that was one part of the class. The other part, of course, is the outreach. And the tefillin at the Kotel, the approach of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, vis-a-vis the approach of the Sachmar Rav. I need not tell you, this repeated itself a few years later with the Yom Kippur, with the Entebbe rescue. Remember, with the Entebbe rescue, I should say, 1976, when the Rebbe declared a nace happened and the Sachmar Rav went crazy against the Lubavitch. How can you say a nace? A nace by Tzvagen Al Yisrael, by Rishon Gemurim. How can you say a nace? And the Rebbe said at a Fabrenian afterwards, if one of the Jews who was rescued would go back to that airport, wouldn't he be chayiv to say the bracha she'asali nace b'mokom hazeh? How can you say it wasn't the nace? The Rebbe was very strong, very forthright, and that's when there was tremendous tension between, that's when the big chabatnik came up, who came to teach in Williamsburg, and very, very sad. I happened to be an American in 77, and I saw on the TV, the Goyeshe TV, they showed Jews getting beaten up, chassid fighting chassid, or beating up chassidim in Williamsburg. Wow, there was tremendous tension. Today, Baruch Hashem, Sachmar is so busy with its infighting among itself that, thank God, their relations with Lubavitch are infinitely better. And
well, I think that also changed when Rav Yerlich passed away.
I understand. Today, the split is so great, and also in Sachmar itself, they have a lot of problems. The Lopashit, off the Derech, off the Sachmar Derech, off the Lakewood Derech, off the Torah Derech. We're all caught up with these problems, and in Sachmar, there's a whole element that is frum and fine and good, and they listen to Rakefet. You understand? This is a serious problem for them. And the whole element wants to come in Aliyah. If anyone's listening and can put a few million dollars together and build, we would go to, they want to go to Givat Zev, where the Kollel Stolner Rebbe is, that would be fabulous. Because the Kollel Stolner Rebbe is, I told you, he's American. I spoke about it, I think, yesterday. And remember, they asked him, how come you don't answer the iPods? They can be, said, I trust my Hasidim. And there's a lot of truth to that. We have to build up. We're not going to win them all. Alex, I know you would like to censor a little bit, but I have found in life that the generation of Balei Tshuva have at times a hard task raising their own children. In Israel, a lot of the OTD from the Haredi world are children of Balei Tshuva, because the parents went crazy to become Jews, and they're trying to protect the kid from all the influence of the outside world. And I did something else in life which turned out to be so correct. I was a very poor father. I was busy working, trying to make a living for food. I'm not talking, I had two food jobs, but I was on the books, tax, the whole economy here was black. So I worked very hard. When grandchildren came along already, life was easier. My children are self-sufficient. And there's nothing, I can still recall two of my grandchildren who are older than I am today saying to each other, there's nothing in the world that Sabu wouldn't get us. They knew I would give them anything. So when the kids would ask me for this or that, and I say, I'm going to give you everything. I would say to my young grandchildren, I'd say, but look how good we are. You kids have everything. You're going to grow older, big world, trefil, Shabbos, and women, and drugs, and liquor. You're going to look for, if I give you everything, you're going to look for treats. You're going to look for all the forbidden things in the world. Will you be able to make a proper choice? And of course, the kids would say, of course. Repeat after me, Ovachata b'chayim. Oh, these kids of us. Reshit Chachmais would tell my grandchildren, you can be atomic scientists, okay? Don't embarrass Morty. You can be atomic scientists. But Reishit Chachma Yirat Hashem, otherwise you're an educated monkey. And Baruch Hashem, those words seem to help. Looking back, I have this evening, I'm entertaining grandchildren and my great-grandson, my latest addition. I will see how much progress he's made since I went to Florida. Now, gentlemen, that's what we did today. Next week's class, I'm reaching a crescendo with these interviews, and then we come into a very painful topic, the critique of Chabad, the main criticism. Nothing to do with Messianicism. That will get down the line. But I'm going to... The critique of Chabad, and I'm leading into a document about Rav Kefet that will also go for $36,000 linked to the shekel. You've got to know what you're getting here. And Sunday's class, it's $99,000 to walk in the door. Oh my gosh, you think Chovei Torah invented feminism? Wait till what the Mishnah Halachat uncovered for me. Mark, I am still shaking. But it's a Rishon. And I'll also give you some insight into new Sparim, how to deal with the Shevet and Shivet. Okay, this is for Yitzchak Noanesia. This is what I alluded to. I can't get over this. Sichat HaShavu of Chabad. This is a Japanese Jew living in Beit Shemesh. It's unbelievable. Now, you understand there's a whole group there.
He's also in Shari Chesed.
Shari Chesed. Yeah. Very famous. He gave up millions of dollars. Very famous. Unbelievable. Do me a favor. This is with the Tamar Epstein. Take this, Morty. Tell me if you can make sense out of it. This is in Bnei Brak, the machleket over the coffee, drinking coffee in the streets. If you read Washington, you know why that means a lot to me. This is on Rav Gorin's father, the family that Rav Gorin comes from, and how they get to Israel. This is on the Kat, the Lev Tahar, that ran out of Montreal to Guatemala. Very interesting what can happen with the Kat. This is from Serugim, about rabbis that have come out against the prenuptial. I tell you, I have a lot of difficulty with this, because many people don't carry on Shabbos because we're choshesh for the Shita Tarambam. You know what I'm talking about. If the Tetzayin Amo, the Rishut Rabbam. And why can't we be samach on the Rambam with Koifin Oto? Why do we have to be so machmed that even the prenuptial is not acceptable? This is on the cemetery in Vilna, on who is buried there. This is very, very fascinating. I actually have the volume published in 1935 on this. That cemetery doesn't exist anymore. It was plowed over by the communists.
Yeah, moved up.
Right. They removed some to the new cemetery.
Yeah, I was there.
Right. I was there in 1989. This is on the Rabbi Ephraim Ushri as a survivor. Look what he looked like as a young man. The man who survived the Kovna ghetto and wrote all the Tshuvot. This is very moving by Rav Manas Friedman about his great uncle and a story where this kid says to his mother, "Bring me a spoon." And his great uncle, who never spoke out, never said anything, wasn't married, suddenly pops up with anger. "How dare you bother your mother for something?" And Rabbi Manas Friedman, a famous Chabadnik, writes, from that he learned how a child has to honor a parent and give to the parent, not vice versa. And this corresponds to the story I told you about my wife's family of Malachim. What was it, last year, 2 years ago, how this fellow in Brooklyn takes out his son to the deli that my wife's family owned, the Sohn family, and the kid's father gets up and brings, this kid had done well in his regents in Torah Vadas, and his father gets up and brings water to the table, and the owner of the store, Malka's relative, gets up, takes the cups of water, spills them out, and he says, "A father doesn't bring for a son brings for a father." And that's exactly the message there. Here's a very fascinating article on Israelis who flee the ultra-Orthodox. And this is about that famous family, the Chelez, who Baruch Hashem didn't leave Yiddishkeit. And they're in Beit Shemesh, if I'm correct, and I hope that Mark and Ora will be makar of them to Torah Hashem Tamima. And here's a picture I share with you. It appears in the Rav, but my Talmud, Rabbi Dr. Lieutenant Colonel Mark Wiener, brought me the original picture, which is really beautiful, 1977. Who do you see here? Moriah Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, and that's Rav David Lipschitz, the Tzu Valka Rav, leaning over. And that's the yeshiva I went to. This brings back a lot of memories. Of course, I remember them much younger. And Rav David's beard was black with one little white hair in the middle. That's the Rav David I met in 1951. And the Rav was basically clean shaven. He had a Van Dyke, but totally shaven here. Notice the Rav's hat is gray. It's either gray or brown. I think it's gray, but it's not in color. But it's absolutely not black. So you see, Barcelona wouldn't make a fortune off the Rav.
Can you make copies of that?
I'll make copies for you, okay? That's why I always make copies, then I'm left, but I am moved to hear that you want a copy. It will be my honor. They will be made tomorrow, Be'ezrat HaNotein LeYov Koach. My dear students, I thank you from the bottom of my heart for honoring me with your presence. I miss Natan Kohn.
I think he's... studying for
I don't know. We studied for Bechinat, but I never missed a class. I had guys from the Kollel, bright guys. On principle, they would never miss a class. Rabbi, I had a Bechinat. I never had a Bechinat. All right. Bechinat are very important. You can't have life without judgment. You read about that from Chaim Dolphin. Rakepet is the worst example in the world, Jason. You know why?
What?
I have never given an exam since the day I came in Aliyah, July 5th, 1969. You know why? Because I came in Aliyah, and those years you came by boat. When you come by plane, that's not an Aliyah. You blow your nose in Brooklyn, and then you use the same handkerchief getting off the plane in Tel Aviv, right or wrong.
True.
But when you come by boat, every day you get closer. You get more humble. A humble person can't give bechinat. So I always made a deal with my deans. If someone attends class, they pass. If you attend and you don't learn, I'm at fault. Okay? I have to teach. But if you don't come, you're at fault. Got it? So I never gave a bechinat. So then in the schools, you know, the other teachers used to complain, no wonder Rabbi Rakepet is so popular, he doesn't give exams. So I used to give a paper. So the paper went as follows. What I was like when I first arrived and what my expectations. At the end of the year, the paper was where I was and where I am. Okay? And those papers later made me give up all my collegiate teaching. Why? I'm being serious. It's not the main reason, but I'm being serious. These girls, I was teaching in Midrashit Moriah, right? Machon Gold, Midrashit Moriah. The amount of divorce in Torah homes, I couldn't handle it. If I say 25% of the students I taught from the mid-80s on came from divorced homes, I'm probably hitting the statistic right on the head. If not 25, 20%. And I would read, one girl wrote, I'd never forget it, that until I reached a certain age, I always thought you spend one Shabbat with your mother and one Shabbat with your father, that was the norm. You follow? And that's why I tell everyone I've seen life. My daughter is a world-famous Tohenet Rabbani, divorce lawyer, so I know all her stories and how many of my students she has handled divorces. And I see beyond here in America, kids always suffer. No one asked you to bring children into the world. You chose to get married. Mm-hmm. Well, if you choose to get married and you have children, you have a responsibility. Those are poor, innocent children. Ribbono shel Olam, if you want to get divorced, wait until all your children are dead. Got it? Then you can get divorced. But when you have children, and I see the children suffer, and 99% of the time, you know, people thought me, but Rebbe, the Torah allows divorce. Correct. But 99% of the time, if you're two decent human beings, you can work it out. You can work it out. There's compromise. You can't be so self-centered. And if a man has any seichel, my grandchildren repeat this one grandson. I love his wife. I say what you did for my grandson. You matured him in 1 year more than 25 years before. And I always taught him, when you get married, you no longer have an opinion on small matters. You just have an opinion on big matters. I'm paraphrasing the Gemara now, if you recognize it. Dava katan and dava gadol. What's an important opinion? Whether Obama should bomb Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, take the troops out, put the troops in. Should Trump be elected or Chvei said that this Cruz be elected? That you have an opinion about. Everything else, leave to your wife. Bina yutera b'nashim. They know better. And boy, have I seen this in life. Men who are insistent the furniture has to be one color, you don't know what ultimately happens to that personality. I've seen it. It's frightening. Let your wife choose the color. She likes brown. You like gray. You live with the brown. You're the boss on when to finish Shas. She's the boss on what to make for supper and what dress to buy your daughter and what color shirt to buy your son. Oy, common sense. Life can be beautiful. Don't mess it up. All right. Gentlemen, gnug. 56 years of marriage and Baruch Hashem. I am not looking back. God should give strength to go further. You see, Rabbi, you should know Rabbi Reuben, we have a mutual friend, Dr. Dershowitz. So Sam just lost his wife. You know what it means? He was married 59 years. It's heartbreaking. And then God gives you another smack. He was just dropped. But you have just dropped. My building, we're in Rehavia, the first three floors, one down entrance and one above, every last apartment has been robbed. And here a man has just gotten up shiva, just adjusting, just after Shloshim, and they're such a beautiful, beautiful couple. And Barbara, my wife's best friend, you don't know the loss for us, but I can't compare for David, for Sam, it's Churban Beis Hamikdash, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Chavbet. So he's robbed. But it's not over yet. You won't believe this. Next door to him, this was the apartment of Charlie Pam, Rabbi Avram Pam's older brother. So Charlie's apartment has been sold, resold. These people bought it. They redid the whole apartment. And I don't know why they put a camera in that takes pictures of people entering and leaving. Do you know that they have a picture of the people who went in? They went to see if Sam is in. They climbed in through a window, had a machine that pulled the bars apart, and they think they're Jews, the police said, because they didn't take the gun. Sam has a gun with a license. The Arabs take the gun. The Jews leave it because if a Jew robs a gun, they throw the book at him. This way, it's stammer robbery of a gun. So Sam, the police called Sam, have you looked at the pictures yet? You go with a computer, it's a world beyond me. Sam said, yes, we're making a diskette for you. So we're all betting. You know what went on in shul this morning? The whole minyan, will the police solve it? You know, what level are these police on? I have to tell you, I say they're going to solve it. Nechia v'nira. Until we meet again in health and happiness. Das v'danya. If anyone wants a picture of the shul in Bal Harbor, you're welcome to it. It's unbelievable what they've built there. It's literally a block and a half away from the Chabad shul, and they live b'shalom u'b'shalom.